From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA National Security correspondent Jeff Selden. Welcome, Anita and Jeff.
Pleasure to be here.
My pleasure.
Well, here are the issues. The U.S. debt ceiling bill passed the House of Representatives with broad bipartisan support. The U.S. Senate will now take up the bill to lift the federal government's $31.4 trillion debt limit and send it to President Joe Biden to sign. First Lady Jill Biden aims to promote empowerment for women and young people as she visits the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. The trip also includes attending Jordan's royal wedding. The GOP primary field is getting more crowded as former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is set to announce his 2024 presidential campaign. Also, former Vice President Mike Pence is also set to throw his hat into the GOP primary ring. On the international front, U.S. officials say a U.S. military aid package for Ukraine will total up to $300 million and will include additional munitions for drones. Six African leaders proposed that Ukraine accept opening peace talks with Russia. South African officials plan to visit both Ukraine and Russia to sell the idea. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. And looking at the debt ceiling, and it's been passed in the House, and now it goes to the Senate, is there any chance that the Senate will not pass it, Anita?
So the Senate is largely controlled by the Democratic Party. This is a budget that has been promoted by the Biden administration. So I'm not in the business of making predictions, but I do think that it is likely that Democrats will fall in line and push this through, because the goal now is to get this to the president's desk before the scary X date, which is the date that the U.S. will run out of money to pay its bills, which we're now estimating is going to be June 5th.
Jeff, your take on this.
Look, the Democrats only have a slim majority in the Senate. It's likely they'll fall in line and support this budget. We've also heard from the Senate Republican leader that he's going to support this debt ceiling agreement. So it looks likely it can pass. The question is going to be how many lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, some Democrats and some Republicans who are either on the far left or the far right, including perhaps some Republicans who are defense hawks, who are very concerned about the defense budget implications of this deal. What will they do during the process? And will they seek to delay it? Will there be any grandstanding, as lawmakers are sometimes wont to do? There are still some hurdles. It's likely it will pass. The consequences for the U.S. if it does not pass this debt ceiling agreement and the U.S. is unable to pay its bills are wide-ranging, from, you know, not being able to pay basic bills to what intelligence officials have said this could do in terms of the U.S. reputation abroad, with countries, especially like China and Russia, using this in disinformation narratives or misinformation narratives to push against the U.S. and erode U.S. standing in the world. So it's likely it's going to pass. But as always, politics is a messy business, and there could be some bumps along the way before this ultimately gets done.
And just in looking at this whole situation, why was this process such an incredible undertaking for lawmakers this time around?
That's a great question. And that's a question that the Biden administration has asked repeatedly, like, why can't elected representatives do their job and lift the debt ceiling? To be clear, this debt ceiling, this is money that the United States has already spent. And so to use the extremely flawed household government spending analogy that Kevin McCarthy likes to use, you can compare all you like, but if you've already bought the car, if you've already bought the house, if you already owe the debt, then there's not really a conversation to be had about whether you're going to pay for it. You still have to pay for it. You're on the hook for it. This came down to basically the Republican Party, especially the far right wing of the Republican Party, is really on a mission to cut spending. They feel like this is the solution for the United States, because basically we have a budget deficit, and there are basically three ways that you can shore that up. One is to cut defense spending, which nobody wants to do. The other is to cut spending, which includes things like entitlements and social programs. The third thing is to increase taxes, which the Republican Party does not want to do. So it came down to where they could cut to have what may ultimately be a Pyrrhic victory. The Republican Party is selling this as a win, as something that they've delivered for the American people. But really, nobody is happy with the budget that was passed in the House. So it remains to be seen whether this is going to be really effective and beneficial for the American people.
The other thing to consider here, and long before I covered national security, I covered politics and local politics at that. And it comes back to that saying, all politics are local. So for a lot of the lawmakers involved here in the House and the Senate, Republican and Democrat, a lot of them will look at what's happening and they think about, what does this mean for my constituents, both in terms of whether it's good for them or bad for them, but also what does it mean for their chances of getting elected next time they're up for election? And for a growing number of lawmakers, and we've seen this change over the last 20, 30 years, there is less and less incentive for them to make any deals, for them to have any sort of compromise. And increasingly, lawmakers of both parties see an advantage when they stake out an issue and they make a big deal about it and they don't compromise. Sometimes that has disastrous or negative consequences for the country as a whole, but for them and their chances of getting reelected and staying in power, it's good. And so because there's less incentive to compromise, they see that playing out to their benefit in the long run.
And very good points that you all have raised on this issue. Well, let's move on to U.S. First Lady Jill Biden. She's on a 6-day trip to Jordan, Egypt, Morocco, and Portugal. And she is attending the royal wedding of Jordan's Crown Prince Al Hussein. And this is her first visit to the Middle East. What does she hope to accomplish on her trip?
A few things. She's, of course, going to be pushing her message of women's empowerment and also the youth, because this is a very salient issue, especially on the African continent where the median age is 19. It's a very youthful continent. And we've seen pretty much across the board in African countries that no matter how progressive the law or the constitution, non-male people, women, as we might call them, are conventionally left out or put at a disadvantage. And she is ostensibly going to shore that up. What's interesting about this trip is none of these three countries that she's going to are considered, quote unquote, free, according to rankings by Freedom House, which is a well-respected NGO that ranks perceptions of freedom in countries. Jordan is a constitutional monarchy. Egypt has a lot of issues with freedom of the press, freedom of expression, freedom of movement. I could go on and on. And Morocco is, of course, a monarchy as well. This is very interesting because this is a place where the First Lady, who is not elected, who is basically like a member of a royal family, kind of born to the role, I suppose, can work on norm change without coming up against the awkward reality of this not being an ideal governance situation for the United States, which is really pushing democracy. So she has a little room to maneuver here where maybe the president of the United States might not. So I think this trip is going to be very interesting. Having traveled with the First Lady before, I've seen how she pretty reliably rises to the occasion and handles everything in a way that's very different from her husband, both by design, because as I said, she doesn't have formal power, but also just in her personality as an educator and, dare I say, as a woman.
There's also a more practical view that you can take of the importance of this trip when you talk about countries like Jordan and Egypt. These are long-term allies of the U.S. that play critical roles in the Middle East and in the geopolitics of the Middle East. And when you take a step back and you look at how Russia is increasingly trying to get into the Middle East, when you look at China, they're increasingly trying to get a foothold into the Middle East. These countries become very important. So even if it's not talking the hardcore politics, a high-profile visit by a high-profile U.S. person is something that makes a difference and reminds these countries of the ties with the U.S. and the friendship with the U.S. And despite all the difficulties, despite the human rights concerns, it gives the U.S. a chance to shore up that relationship as it deals with a turbulent time in that region.
Here in the U.S., Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, he stepped up his attacks on Republican rival Donald Trump as he kicked off his first campaign swing as a presidential candidate in Iowa. Well, as time goes on, will DeSantis chip away at supporters of Trump or will Trump remain the front runner?
New polling suggests that the traditional, they're called primary lanes in the GOP primary, have really shrunk down to two, and that's the always Trump lane and the sometimes Trump lane. But the problem here is the sometimes Trump lane, the people who are not Donald Trump, are pretty numerous. We have several entrants into this race already. We have Ron DeSantis. We have, as you mentioned, Mike Pence will be throwing his hat in. Chris Christie, Vivek Ramaswamy, just such a long list. I can't even remember all their names. And then in the always Trump lane, there's one dude, Donald Trump. Nobody else is Donald Trump. The prognostication is if there's a multi-car pileup in the sometimes Trump lane, Donald Trump is just going to cruise through and sweep up all of the support and become the nominee. That's what analysts are seeing right now as this race shapes up in interesting ways.
When you look back at the history of presidential politics and even over the last several decades about how races shape up both in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, there are times that you could go back and say, you know what? You didn't see that coming. You didn't see that candidate emerging. But with the Republican presidential primary and with Donald Trump in particular, it feels like it's a different type of situation. I don't know that the country has ever seen a politician like Donald Trump who is so adept at getting out his message and resonating with his base supporters in the way that he is. And it seems like it almost overshadows what other politicians are going to do. Does that mean that eventually, as things play out, something can change? Not necessarily. Look, there's reporting, media reportings about an audio recording of former President Trump where allegedly he's talking about classified documents that he kept with him that he wasn't supposed to. And there's an investigation into that. Could there be charges there? There are other investigations that could pile up. What impact will that have ultimately if he's convicted in any of these things? There's the investigation in New York that's moving forward. How does a conviction potentially between now and the election impact his standing with his supporters? Does it just make it stronger? There are a lot of people who see that happening, but is there something that could happen that could weaken that support? But again, he resonates very loudly and very strongly with the base of the Republican Party right now. And so that makes him the presumptive favorite now in going into the general election, at least among Republicans.
Very good points that you all have brought up on this issue. And as both have pointed out, we still have a long ways to go for a lot of things to happen. Well, it's time now for a quick break, and when we come back, the U.S. ramps up military aid to Ukraine. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference, USA, and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA National Security correspondent Jeff Selden. Well, U.S. officials say a military aid package for Ukraine will total up to $300 million and will include additional munitions for drones and rockets. So what can we expect in the coming days or weeks, Jeff?
Well, the U.S. is providing this package, which will have some key help for the Ukrainians. It includes more Patriot air defense batteries, ammo for the batteries. It includes air defense systems, air defense missiles. It includes ammunition for the HIMARS systems, which Ukraine has been able to use to target Russian command and control centers, weapons and supply depots that are behind the lines, and systems that have really helped alter the course of this conflict from where it was seen as Ukraine perhaps losing very rapidly to the point where U.S. defense officials, U.S. intelligence officials at this point don't see an end in sight. One of the key things I think in this package is going to be the air defense systems and the ammo for those systems, because the idea of air superiority has been a big concern. And even though Ukraine's been asking for more fighter jets and for longer range missiles, what they have so far has really been able to negate what on paper was a Russian advantage, and that was in the air with their air force. And nobody has air superiority. Nobody is able to dominate the skies, and that has given Ukraine room to operate on the ground and push back against the Russians. So that's going to help. The problem is that no matter how much the U.S. gives Ukraine right now, there's no sense that momentum is really changing on the ground. And again, we haven't seen Ukraine's counteroffensive, which has been much talked about so far.
I actually have a question or two for Jeff on this one. Do you think that Ukraine is telegraphing its punches a little bit too much in delaying this promised counteroffensive? And number two, can you talk to us a little bit about what the F-16s are doing? Because we heard that, of course, the F-16s are going to be transferred to Ukraine. But can you just give us a timeline on the implications of that?
Well, with the first question in terms of Ukraine telegraphing its punches, it's interesting, and it's something that's come up in discussions I've been trying to have with intelligence and defense officials, and they don't say very much, at least here in the U.S. But it's interesting. Ukraine has talked a lot about this. In the last time around, when Ukraine was going to launch a counteroffensive, there was a lot of talk, and there were some specifics that were tossed out there. And then Ukraine did something when they launched a counteroffensive that nobody was expecting, and it really put Russia on its heels. So whenever you have a war like this, it's playing out in public. It's not just about what actually is going to happen. It's about all the misinformation and disinformation being tossed out into the environment to create confusion for the adversary. There are questions about what Ukraine is actually going to do, and whether or not is some of this misdirection, is some of this trying to confuse the Russians, or is it possible that Ukraine has concerns about the weaponry, the ammo, the supplies that it needs in order to do what it wants to do on the ground? So it's a good question. And it remains to be seen how this counteroffensive that Ukraine has been talking about, and that senior U.S. officials, including the director of the chief spy agency, the CIA, have talked about publicly for months now, when's it going to come? How is it going to play out? We're all waiting to see. But there is some analysis. British intelligence officials have noted in particular that as we've been waiting for this counteroffensive, Russia has become more reactionary. At the beginning of this conflict, when Russia invaded, obviously it was the aggressor. It was trying to set the tone. It was trying to set the pace for what was going to happen. And more over the last several months, Russia has started reacting to what Ukraine is doing. And Ukraine, even though this conflict is seen as a stalemate in terms of where the fighting is happening and how it's happening, British intelligence officials see Ukraine is setting the tone there. So that's interesting to watch. On the F-16s, you know, the U.S. has held out for a long time on endorsing the idea of giving Ukraine these more modern, up-to-date, more capable fighter jets, and it's come around on that. The U.S. officials have basically been saying, look, it's not going to make a difference right now in the fight in many ways, and they point to the Ukraine's ability to use its current air defense system to create that stalemate when it comes to air superiority and prevent Russia from being able to dominate the skies and in some ways dictate how this war plays out on the ground in Ukraine. They have said, however, and NATO officials have said this too, that there's an eye towards looking more long term to what Ukraine is going to need, not just today, not just next week, not just next month, but in the years to come, and almost looking at what happens to Ukraine after this conflict is over. And NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg came out with some comments indicating that Ukraine eventually will become a member of the NATO alliance, which is something that Russia doesn't want to happen. And it's almost like he said the quiet part out loud, because U.S. officials and European officials have talked about the need to integrate Ukraine into NATO standard systems for interoperability. Obviously, it's not going to happen during this conflict, because if Ukraine was a member of NATO, that would trigger Article 5 in the U.S. and all these European NATO members immediately would be at war with Russia, which is something that nobody wants to see. But clearly, more and more, as the White House hears the threats coming from Russia and doesn't see stuff playing out on the ground, doesn't see Russia backing up those threats, there seems to be a greater willingness to provide Ukraine with more advanced weaponry, and weaponry that just a year ago was deemed too provocative to share in this conflict because of what it might provoke Russia to do. And as Russia has not backed up its angry statements and its saber rattling, we might be expect more and more of these weapon systems and these advanced systems to start flowing to Ukraine from the West.
In the meantime, six African leaders are proposing that Ukraine accept opening peace talks with Russia, even as Russian troops remain on its soil. So what is prompting these African leaders to want to engage with both Russia and Ukraine?
One thing, grain. These six leaders, the presidents of South Africa, Senegal, Egypt, Republic of Congo, Uganda, and Zambia, are going to be hosted both in Kyiv and in Moscow. And their overarching objective, of course, is to open the floor for peace talks. But the bigger issue is, for these leaders at least, is that there was a deal struck such that Ukraine could export grain to the rest of the world, and Russia would permit this through the blockaded port. And that deal is about to expire, and they need this extended because otherwise people are going to starve. There's no nicer way to put it. People are going to starve on the African continent. These leaders are already in their own particular ways fighting domestic pressures at home, fighting inflation, looking to re-election, some of them. And so this is their main priority, to make sure that their people can eat. This really underscores how this conflict is not just between two countries. I mean, I think we know that, but we kind of think about it in the East-West context without thinking about how direly and how dramatically this conflict has affected the global South, the developing world, which needs Russian fertilizer and Ukrainian grain to just straight up survive. And so this delegation of leaders, who, as I said, are some pretty impressive leaders, some hard dudes. I mean, you have the longtime president of the Republic of Congo, the longtime president of Uganda, and then a Zambian, a Senegalese, an Egyptian, and a South African thrown in. I mean, this is not a delegation to be underestimated. These guys have dealt with conflict in the regional sense, in the continental sense, and these guys are political survivors. So I wouldn't underestimate them at the table. And I think it is important that the combatants in this conflict, especially Moscow, hear how their actions are frankly hurting the rest of the world, and to take that into account and to do something to open the door to ease that suffering all around the world.
I think we can also take this and flip it upside down, flip it on its head to another perspective. And like, what is Russia looking to gain from this? What is Ukraine is looking to gain from this? I mean, we've heard Ukraine's President Zelensky speaking about at public forums how Ukraine for a long time ignored Africa, and that was a mistake. And it's important to talk to African countries and engage with them. And that's something that Ukraine under Zelensky has been trying to do more so, partly to gain support for its efforts to fend off the Russian invasion. But there is a sense perhaps that this is about more too in terms of the major global power competition between Russia and the U.S. and China. And these countries may to some extent also be trying to find out where do they stand? Where do their best interests lie? But if they have to take a side, where are their best interests going to be served? And so I think there's some feeling out there as well on that grander scale in terms of the major power competition, Russia, U.S. Keep an eye on how China might come into this as well, because China, Anita, as you well know, has increasingly been courting countries in Africa, trying to establish footholds in Africa, military bases in Africa, in addition to economic projects. So while the grain is important from a macro level, it's also very interesting to see how this is playing out, because it could have impacts way down the line, far beyond the Ukraine-Russian conflict and war.
Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Anita, what is weighing on your mind this week?
I've been keeping a close eye on relations between Beijing and the Taliban. They are getting extremely cozy. This started, of course, right after the American withdrawal, but it's been getting closer and closer in recent months. In fact, in recent weeks, we're now having direct flights between the two countries. Now, this is interesting because the Taliban is looking for legitimacy, and China, of course, is looking to maintain stability with their neighbor. So this is a very interesting dynamic with huge implications, because China also does need a lot of the things that are under Afghan soil, namely lithium and other minerals. And so I've asked the White House several times about how they see this, and they've kind of shrugged it off. But I do think that this is an interesting relationship to watch, and I'm keeping a very close eye on it.
Very good. And Jeff?
One of the things I've been watching is the growing debate and the growing concern over artificial intelligence. A group of more than 350 scientists, tech company executives signed a letter, a statement, essentially a one-line statement saying that artificial intelligence could lead to the extinction of mankind. The technology behind AI could doom humanity, which is seems like a pretty dire warning. But it's one that U.S. officials, including cyber officials and some intelligence officials, have been saying for some time. Just this past May, the director of the lead cybersecurity agency was giving a talk at Vanderbilt University in the United States. And she said that while AI will be the most powerful capability of our time, she also said it will be the most powerful weapon of our time. And so you see this very delicate dance that cybersecurity officials, intelligence officials are doing, trying to get a handle on just how dangerous AI can be, from misinformation to something worse. The scenarios that have been thrown out include using an AI-generated how-to guide to plan a dinner party, while criminal enterprises or rogue nations are using it to develop cyber weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons that could, in fact, doom humanity. So there's a lot of concern there. There's talk about how to regulate, how to get this under control, but there are still a lot more questions than answers.
Very good. Thank you. And we will end the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell and VOA National Security correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join us next weekend for more Issues in the News.